This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Fiona Deering from Lara, Australia, and you are listening to a special Australian edition of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for November 12, brought to you today by Remote Coach and Chamberlain's Law Firm. Good morning, Horse World.
Everyone has a place. They're not just horses, they're part of my family.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to a weekend edition of Horses in the Morning, our little magazine edition. And, of course, Fiona is back. Fiona, you wouldn't even have to say it's the Australian edition. We can just tell by your accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're good.
Okay. I'm always scared I'm going to start mimicking you because I'm a really bad mimic. If I travel with someone with an accent, I sound like a native within about an hour.
Well, welcome back. It's been an exciting time over there in Australia. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Plus, we have some guests coming up too, don't we? Tell us a little bit about our guests.
We sure do. Today we have Lance Justice, who's a harness racing trainer. He's got a pretty cool story about a racehorse of his that was bitten by a snake, which is timely at the moment in Australia because all the wriggly things are starting to come out and try and kill us. And we've also got David Shoebridge, who was fortunate enough to have two of his horses selected to be in the recent Carl Hester Masterclass. So looking forward to talking to both of those great people.
I thought that living in Florida was dangerous with all our critters. Australia's like Florida on steroids.
Yeah. When I had a friend send me one of the best text messages I've ever received when I was up in far north WA one year, where there are, you know, way too many things below knee height that can kill you. And she sent me a message saying, for God's sake, come home before something bites you.
Pretty much true.
Yeah, but you know, the snakes are out and about. I've seen a few out at my horses, and you kind of generally just see tails disappear, and you know, that still makes me squeal like a girl. Freaks me out. But you know,
I'm
most
not a big
of the time
snake fan bad. Either. I don't
know. No. And the problem with, you know, most of ours will kill you. So
yeah, you know, not a fan.
Not a fan. Not a fan.
You know, by the problem is with snakes, by the time you see it get done being freaked out and actually look at it, you don't have time to determine whether it's deadly or not.
I'm not waiting to ask the question. No. Spayed. Relocation process.
Well, a couple of things here before we get to our first guest. One is you had a new standardbred. You already had one. Now you got two?
Yeah, apparently they're like jelly beans. You can't just have one. So young Cheech, as I'm calling him, arrived. He's actually a trotter. He's a square gaiter. So he arrived about 3 weeks ago, 3-4 weeks ago. And I've started him to saddle. And he's had half a dozen or eight rides. And he's being a super good boy. But, oh, wow, he's going to be advertised with the words personality plus, which is code for don't leave anything in reach of him. He's pulled down the electric fencing. He rips rugs. He grabs anything he can reach. And he fancies himself quite the comedian. You're picking up his paddock and he's knocking your hat off. He's very sweet, but he's really annoying.
That's funny.
Even poor Legs, the big one I've still got, just looks at him and almost rolls his eyes going, dude, just calm down.
Well, you know, you always have, if you have two, you always have one that's like that, right?
Oh,
you always have one of those. Now, was he right off the track?
No, he'd been let down since July. He'd had a small suspensory ligament issue.
Which he'd apparently only had... isn't bothering him anymore.
No, no, seems fine. He had only 13 starts, but he won half a dozen of them, and they tried to bring him back in two or three times because his full brother has just won the four-year-old Breeders' Cup in Victoria. So he's nicely bred and was a fairly decent racehorse, but, you know, they've done the right thing and retired him before he really injured himself. And his trainer is really quite involved in his progress. We text message back and forth, and he's really genuinely interested in how he's going. So that's really nice.
Oh, that's
as well.
Nice to know. You don't see that a lot, do you?
No, and he's always happy to hear how he's going. So he'll have another... you know, another few weeks of work, and then we'll see if we can find him another home where he can destroy their rugs. I've even taken off a heavier rug on him because, if you know, he can't have nice things, I've decided.
He needs one of those old canvas ones. You remember those? Yeah, you know, those that were super tough that nobody could, because they weighed about 1,000 pounds when they were wet.
He's just that annoying kid, you know. He annoys horses over the fence. He's got bits off his face. He's he's just that kid.
Yeah,
he's
I got one of those here, class. And he's called Scooter, and he's a little pony.
Yeah, yeah, he is. Yeah, maybe I can send him to you. And
yeah,
he and
Scooter, and he can work
play.
It out.
Yeah, that'd be fun. He's Bay. You could, well, he's 16 hands. You could put, no, probably not in the
Scooter
pairs.
Scooter could probably walk under him.
Yeah. So he's 16 hands, and I refer to him as the little horse because the other one's 17-1. So, yeah, but he's being a good boy, and I'm really enjoying having them both around when he's not, you know, wrecking stuff.
Well, I also, of course, the Melbourne Cup happened, what, a week or two ago, and your big race, you're like Kentucky Derby over there.
Yeah, big, big. Well, it's a
actually bigger, but you know, the only coverage we got over here was of the drunken people causing all kinds of trouble. That's the coverage that we got. I don't even know who won the race because the only coverage over here was how it was a drunk fest.
It's pretty messy. It's pretty messy. I remember going to the Cox Plate a number of years ago, which is another race in the carnival, in the spring racing carnival, and I was with friends in the members stand, and one of the girls in the group was pregnant, so none of us drank. We just watched the races for the day, and the nearest bathrooms were actually the public bathrooms rather than going all the way through the members bar. And, oh, it was very messy in there. But, you know, we were able to take the high ground because we were all completely sober. We nodded our heads and went, oh, that's trashy. But, yeah, it is a bit messy. But a horse called Almanden, A-L-M-A-N-D-I-N, won. And, I mean, it wasn't a very exciting race, to be honest. But the interesting thing about this horse is that his sire, Monsun, who is a German sire, I believe. He is also the sire of the 2013 Melbourne Cup winner, Fiorente, and the 2014 Melbourne Cup winner, Protectionist. So I imagine his stud fee just went up a little bit.
A little bit, yes.
Yeah. So,
and it was a jockey that had won it back in, what, 2000 and then came back and won again, or 2002, something like that?
Karen McAvoy was the jockey, and yes, he has won a previous cup, and I'm just trying to remember what horse that was on. He rode a horse called Brew in the 2000 Melbourne Cup and won, an Australian bred horse. Clearly Australian bred when it's called Brew. So that was exciting, but yeah, it just wasn't a very exciting race. The Cox Plate this year was very exciting with my favourite girl, Winx, beating everyone by about 10 lengths. And in fact, the second horse in that is a horse called Hartnell, who ran third in this year's Melbourne Cup, and she beat him by, you know, 8 to 10 lengths in the Cox Plate. So she won't go, she's not a super distance horse. She wouldn't go the distance of the Melbourne Cups. So she obviously didn't run, but wow, she gave them all a galloping lesson, that's for sure.
And now, speaking of fillies and mamas in this case, the most popular horse I think that we know about in Australia was Black Caviar.
Yeah.
And Black Caviar's working on the baby thing.
She has her first foal, which they've called Oscratia. Oscratia. Oh, gosh, I can't say.
Why do they do this to the announcers? Well, That's my question.
I know. It's apparently the most expensive caviar you can buy, so that makes sense.
I got it.
Yeah, makes sense now. There's a ABC show in Australia called Australian Story, who they do a half an hour special on something Australian each week. They just did an Australian story on Black Caviar and this first offspring, which is now a two-year-old filly. And she's in pre-training with one of our top trainers, David Hayes. So they're suggesting an autumn start for her. So somewhere around April-ish, April-May will be Oscratia's first start. And her stable name is Gertie, which I think is pretty cool.
Hey, Charlotte Desjardins was over here doing all kinds of seminars and doing clinics and everything. And I hear that her boss, Carl Hester, was over there.
Yeah, last weekend I was lucky enough to go to the Carl Hester Masterclass.
You got to go?
Yeah, I went. Yeah, well, it was just down the road from me. So, it was great. So I think we went in about 5 o'clock and it finished at 10:30, 11:30. He worked with a number of riders and horses from sort of four-year-old horses up through to the Grand Prix horses. And it was great. I mean, he's so engaging and interesting anyway, over and above the pure mechanics of dressage. They had 2,500 people there. And some trade stands and a dinner break, and it was
2,500 auditors.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Yep. Yeah.
Was that set a record? That's a lot.
Well, I think it probably does. Really.
For something like that, I bet you it's close. Yeah,
they've been promoting it for a long time. And David Shoebridge, who's one of our guests today, he actually had three horses selected by Carl to be ridden in the clinic, and we talk about how that selection process occurred. And he ended up having two actually go in on the day. But, he speaks about how, he's riding in there in front of 2,500 people, which just doesn't happen for our Australian riders. They haven't, if they're competing in Australia, you don't ride in front of 2,500 people very often, that's for sure. So, yeah, it was great and learnt lots. And, it was a real treat to have him come out. And the best news is he says he's coming back.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was great fun. Plus, they had a bar open, so my friends and I...
Plus, you got to pay the bills. That's the other thing. He has to pay the bills.
Yep. No, we had some mum champagne while we were sitting there watching him, and it was all very classy. It was a lovely afternoon, evening.
I'm glad you got to see that. I mean, how many times would you get to see that? Yeah. I assume he's we talked about how good an instructor Charlotte was, and she was tough. I mean, she was tough on the riders. So what did you take away from him?
The way he presented stuff just made a couple of things really clear for me. Things that I as a rider, but it was just presented in a different way. Just that consistency and that basics, your rhythm has to come back all the time. Even the Grand Prix horses, he was like, no, it's got to be about the rhythm. And I know I've seen Charlotte before also, and every single transition has to be perfect. He was great, and he was really tough on the riders. Like, glad they were out there and not me, that's for sure. I think I would have just curled up in a corner and cried. But fair, and it was really about having the horses work better, being fair on the horses, and having your training be really, really clear and really, really consistent. He was great. And my horses are so happy that he came. Not. I got on the big horse the next day and went, right, time to step it up, my friend.
You go to work.
Yep. But no, he was great. And you know, so personable and so entertaining and engaging and funny. And, you know, he really, really great presenter.
Very cool. That we, of course, we're talking about Carl Hester. Yeah. Well, we need to go to our first guest, don't we?
We sure do. In January, Australian pacer Lovin' a Chevy was bitten by a snake. So Australian. He probably shouldn't have survived, and around-the-clock care pulled him through. On August 15th this year, he returned for a trial, and last week he had his third start back. Lance Justice, his trainer, will let us know what happened next. Welcome, Lance, and thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, how you going? It's very good. Good to be on your show.
He was bitten in January. Is that correct?
January 29th. He was at an adjustment farm. He was having a little bit of a break. He'd been very successful in his previous half dozen starts, and he's gone a new lifetime mark of 154.3 for him for the mile.
Yep.
And he went for a spell, and we got a call from the adjustment farm, and they said that he is not happy. So I jumped in the truck and whizzed up and got him and brought him home, and he seemed to be running a bit of a temperature, but it didn't seem to be anything that was going to be major.
Yep.
And overnight we came out next morning at 6 a.m. and he was just down and just out, and we immediately got vets out and found that he'd been bitten by a snake the afternoon before.
Unfortunately, had a little bit of experience in this also with a good friend of mine whose standard bred was bitten by a snake this time last year, and I'm very well familiar of what it's like to have such a big horse like that go down with snake bite. It was awful. I mean, I know what it's like.
Well, let me ask, what kind of snake was it? Do you know? Do they know?
Well, we think the culprit was a king brown, only because about 3 or 4 days after, the adjustment farm actually found a king brown snake not far from his paddock.
Okay.
Doesn't that matter to what they give him then, as far as the, you know, the anti-venom? Doesn't that matter that they actually know what snake it is or not?
I actually thought it did matter, and I know that when people get bitten, they run a test. You put a test kit over it, and it gives you a different color, and then it tells you, over sight, tells you what snake it was. But they give him the king brown anti-venom straight away, and then they give him a tiger snake anti-venom as a backup. That's how it was explained to me. But
oh, okay. So they cover both bases.
Yeah, but I mean, they once the horse is down, and if they don't get up, they can't get up, that's virtually the end of them. I mean, you only spend, I think, 2 days down, and they'll fill their lungs fill up with fluid, and that's the end of the horse.
Yeah. So I've seen some photos of him up in a sling. How soon did you get him up in the sling?
Well, when he was down, the vets coming up the next morning, I rang three vets straight away. I just thought the first one that gets here is going to do the job, because they're all capable vets and great vets in Australia. We're lucky, we're blessed that way, that we've got such good vets on call. And Virginia Brosnan came in first, and she said, he looked at him, and because he'd been thrashing all night, one side of his face was horrifically blown up, and you could hardly see his eye, and he had skin off. And I'd rolled him over straight away to try and get him up. We tried to get him up. We sort of half got him up and rolled him over. And I thought, she looked at him and she shook her head and she said to me, "This is going to be really hard. This is not good. And you've got to look at the other option first. You've got to say, one, is how much effort do you want to put into saving this horse? Because if you put in an effort, if you say we're going to try and save this horse, it can't be 10% or 20%. It'll have to be 100%.
Yeah, and around the clock, you know, like 24 hours.
Yeah, and that's what she explained, that it wouldn't be just a quick fix, you know, give him something and then let him bend for himself. He would need 100% attention around the clock. Yeah. And I looked at him, and I had the stable staff here, my daughter, and we all looked. Everybody was coming in to try and sort of coach him to get up and try and, you know, see what was wrong with him, because not very often you come out, there's a horse just flaked out in his paddock.
yeah.
and he can't move. And he had lost power in his hind legs at the stage. He was starting to get paralysed behind.
Yeah.
And so that's why we couldn't get him to his feet. So I just said to her, look, don't worry about financial costs. Just if we're going to save him, let's have a go. Let's try and save him. I mean, he's not a superstar horse, and that never come into it. The fact that he was suffering and he was in pain,
yeah,
and yeah, we just wanted to save him because yeah. So we went forward and just straight away decided that it was going to be a job that we were going to take on, and that job meant for the next at least 2 weeks there was very little sleep in the place. I mean, we had to be up with him all night. The
yeah.
first night, I had a really big race meeting to go to that night, and I'd been invited there because one of my horses had won the big race years earlier, and I was invited there as the night, and I was going to take that horse there to lead the field out. And this horse, Chevy, was so sick that I couldn't go, so I got one of the other boys to take the horse over, and I stayed with him all night, and he was on drips, and he'd been on antivenin, and he'd been on the strongest antibiotic that they could give him, and we had blood tests done every 2 hours, and they were racing them back to the laboratories just to make sure that he still had kidney function and liver function, and he wasn't going to die on us, and we weren't wasting our time completely. And, you know, when the vet looked at him and she saw his face was all blown up, she said about putting him down. I actually picked his head up and said, but look at this side. Look at this bright eye and this face. This horse wants to live. And you could see in his eye he wanted to live.
Yep.
And that's why we pushed on. But we had a few things go against us, you know, because where he flaked out was an outdoor paddock. It's only a little small sand yard, a little shelter. And that night about midnight, we had a thundery squall come through, and it looked like it was going to pour with rain. And that's the last thing we needed to do was get wet, even though it was summer.
Yeah.
So we had to find a tarpaulin. We found one, but things fell into place for us because someone come up with a tarpaulin that we put a tractor in the yard, tied to the bobcat tractor, tied to the shelter, tied to a tree. So he had a tent over the top of him. We put him on an air mattress straight away to get the pressure sores off him. We rolled it out on the ground, rolled him on top of it, and blew the air mattresses up. There was just lots of stuff that just sort of come to hand that was pretty lucky to have. Because
and you obviously had an army of helpers.
I didn't realise at the time how many helpers I had.
Yeah.
But when I look through those photos that were taken of the horse when he was sick, and I look at all the faces of the people that come and helped, I realise now how many people actually helped.
Yep.
And it gave me a bit of a I must have had blinkers on at the time. I must have had my vision must have been just solely on the horse, because I just felt like that it was just the immediate family, myself, were with him, but there were so many people that were there with us, sat overnight with him, and
yeah.
you know, we sat out there and made sure that, like, we had a bit of a system going that you'd come in late at midnight, you'd roll him over to the other side because he couldn't get up, he couldn't really move, the only movement he had was every 40 or 50 minutes he would have a convulsion and gallop on the ground sideways and knock his legs around. So we put float boots on him, bandages. We put soft beach sand in his yard so when he dug a hole, he didn't try and tear his legs apart. We tried to tape his legs together. We tried to put canvas straps on him to hold him so that he wouldn't hurt himself when he convulsed, because he was virtually having fits all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it was something to do with the fact that he was running such a high temperature and he got like an encephalitis type thing in the swelling of the brain, which wasn't helping him. And yeah, it was all sorts of things. So he's on anti-inflammatories, but it was just a huge thing. You'd roll him over at midnight, then you'd sit there with him, and then 3 o'clock, he'd sort of get a bit restless because he wanted to have a pee and he couldn't stand up and have a pee. And horses hate to urinate when they're lying down. And it was just, he'd get really restless, and then you'd be holding his head down. And then 3 o'clock you'd roll him over, and then you'd try and get a couple of hours sleep yourself, and then 6 o'clock someone else would come. But after about 3 or 4 days, we decided to try and get him up. On the third day, he had a bit of a relapse and looked like he was history.
Yep.
And I said to a friend of mine, can you please, he had an excavator at home, And I said, can you get me the excavator and bring it down? And he brought it down. And he said, the excavator, do you want me to dig a hole to bury him? And I said, not yet. I said, but it's not looking good. And that was the truth of the matter. It wasn't looking good. I said, but I've got another idea. I said, Diane, my partner, I said to her, go over, because she's got a sewing machine that she fixes horse rugs on. I said, go over and take a piece of canvas. I showed her what I wanted. Put some seatbelt straps up the side of it. I want a sling because I want to be able to pick him up. So we decided we'd pick him up with this excavator. So we picked him up.
Okay.
And we got his legs so they were just touching the ground, but he couldn't take any weight. But we're just trying to get weight back on his legs, because if he'd been down any more than like 4, 5 or 6 days, the longer down, the harder it is to get him to get up.
Yeah, you've got a whole new set of problems.
Yeah. So we had him swinging in the air, and we had his legs, and we just let the excavator down to where it was like, it was dead set like picking up a cold sausage. There was just no strength, no rigidness, and he just didn't want to put his legs out. Mm-hmm. And we finally got him to the stage where we were massaging his legs and pulling his legs out and making him, we dropped it down, and he stood for about 2 minutes on his own weight, trembling.
Wow.
So we just lifted it up and kept him. We just kept him there. And we did that probably half a dozen times, like twice, two or three times that day.
Yep.
And about 3 days later, we actually got him to stand on his own and take his own weight. And it was like it was a big, everybody cheered and said, oh, great, he's standing. And then the next effort was to get him to take a couple of steps, which he took a couple of steps. But it was then we started to realize that he didn't seem to have any real coordination after about a, we'd put him up in the morning, lift him up in the morning, first thing, let him stand, and by mid-afternoon he'd be back down, and then we'd have to roll him over all night. And then it got to the stage where a few days later he stood for a whole day, and then he went down overnight. But it took actually 6 weeks from the snake bite it was 6 weeks after he was bitten before he could actually get off the ground and get up himself.
Wow.
So for 6 weeks, in the first 4 weeks we used excavator. The next 2 weeks I made up a rig on the bobcat to pick him up because he didn't need quite so much help. And the last week or two, 10 days, we were picking him up every morning. There was, I'd have four people would come in the yard. We'd have a sling each and his underbelly thing, which we, because he'd be laying down on the soft sand, we'd have to dig out underneath him, slide the sling underneath him, get someone on his head just to keep him straight, and we'd pick him up. And he got more and more strength in his hind quarters, and he could eventually pick himself up. And it was the day we come out and he actually got up, it was like everybody just cheered. They just said, fantastic, look, this horse is up.
This is one of those, I got to give you guys credit. This is one of those things you start, and once you're in it for a couple days and you see there's hope, then it becomes a mission, doesn't it? No matter how long this was going to take, you guys were fighting a battle with that horse and you were going to make it happen.
That's exactly right, you know. And the saddest thing for us was, the saddest thing on people's faces was to me, was when, and even myself, when he would have a relapse, when he would come good one day and the next day would be like, he'd be like so bad, and you'd be thinking, oh my God, we're going to lose him. We've gone this far. We've gone 3 weeks and we're going to lose him. It was touch and go for weeks. It wasn't touch and go for 2 or 3 days. It was just weeks.
I have to know. Get to the past this, because everybody in the audience now wants to know what the heck happened.
Well, I just got to say, once he thought he was a little bit smart, that he could actually walk around his yard, and then he'd become a little bit bold, and we thought, well, after 3 weeks, we thought we'll let him out the front gate of his paddock and he could have a little walk. And some ponies next door went for a run, and he decided he was going to try and run, which was, like, he'd only just started walking, and he fell over.
Oh, geez.
So we had to go pick him up with a tractor again. But what happened was, at the end of the day, he actually got to a point where we thought we'll start walking him. He walked in circles because he couldn't walk in a straight line. We thought he had brain damage through the bite, and we thought that he may never be any good. And he had no muscle, as you can see on those photos, he had no muscles at all. We lost all muscle form, and it was just poor. We started walking him, giving him a little bit of exercise. Then one day he looked really good and he was running around, so I put him in a cart and we walked him a bit further. And the owner said to me, wouldn't it be good if we got him back to racing? And I said, yeah. I said, he's a long way away. I said, well, we'll give him some exercise because he loves to do stuff. Like, even right now, he's standing at his gate in front of us wanting to get out and do some work. That's the sort of horse he is.
Yep.
And we started doing a bit, and Colin Croft, who's had some really good horses, loaned him, said, would you consider racing him again? And I said, only if he was happy with it, and there was no safety issues, and he could get his coordination muscles back. So we got to the stage where we took him to a trial in August, which was 7 months after the bite, and I sent him around, and Jason Hackett, and the boy that works for us, drove him the trial, and I said, I want you to do one thing. I don't want you to have any horses behind him at all. I want you to go around and see if he goes around safe. If you feel he's not safe in any foot stage, don't compete in the trial. So he followed the field around, got beat 300 metres. We then took another, that was in August, then we took another 3 months just quietly with him and go to the races, and he had a couple of starts, and he won the other night at Bendigo.
Oh,
he
led
from barrier three.
Yeah.
And he went 156, which 2 seconds outside of his best mark. But he still went out, competed, and won a race. And look, a young girl drove him for me because he had to have a junior claim to get into this race. And I just said, there's only one instruction with this horse. If he's under pressure, I don't want you to punish him, and I don't want you to use a whip on him at all. I just want you to just drive him. If he's happy to do it, do it.
Well, so, congratulations. Wow, yeah. You guys deserve a medal for all of that. And
I bet you there wasn't a dry eye in the stands at the end of that race.
It was a really strange feeling because I stood there and I watched the race, and I was standing by myself. And I saw him, and he went across the line. I thought, he's won. And I thought it was almost like I had this feeling of deja vu, like if it wasn't for a decision that I made, this course of history or this course of time would never have happened.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it was a really strange feeling. It was just it was an awesome feeling, but it was strange because it was like a godlike feeling because I decided that I was going to try and save him. He had a fair bit to do with himself, of course, but without my decision to try and save his life, I could very easily said, put him down, and it would never have gone around that race.
Which, arguably is the easier course.
No, it would have been simple to do that, right? I mean, would have been the simple thing to do. Yeah.
And you know something else a little bit freaky about it? I just found out yesterday, the horse that was in favorite for the race was called Clark Griswold. And he ran second to Love and a Chevy. Well, Clark Griswold was played by Chevy Chase.
So
in the movie. So Chevy Chase, Love and a Chevy.
That's great.
So it's all like, how could you get that sort of omens, those sort of word plays and stuff, you know?
I got to tell you two things. One is we actually went through an experience like this, and this is what's going to happen to you someday, and you're going to feel so good about it. We adopt greyhounds after they're done. Well, the first greyhound we ever owned had wrecked on the racetrack and had actually flown up in the air and hit the electric wire with its head that makes the bunny go that they chase. So fried his head, broke her back leg. She was a mess, had 100 stitches. And the trainer went out there. They were going to put the dog down on the track, and the trainer said, I will pay to have this dog fixed. 2 years after that, after we adopted that dog, and the only reason we got it is we didn't have kids because the dog was so beat up. 2 years later, we saw that trainer at a picnic, and that dog ran up to that trainer and jumped on her, and we have never seen that dog jump up on anybody before. And that trainer cried that day. So
that's a beautiful story. I mean, you know, that it just, people, you can't tell me that they don't understand. Even this horse now, because we've had so much hands-on attention with him, we laid on him, we slept on him to keep him warm, we cuddled him, we massaged him. He now will come up to you and push you around as if he controls you. at the races the other night. He actually physically, I stood in front of him as we were waiting for the race, and he pushed me out of the way with his head and said, come on, let's go. He's different to other horses now.
Yeah.
He's such an opinionated, he thinks that we owe him so much still.
I got to ask you, the one thing that has come up on this show a number of times is it is so expensive here in the United States. When you get bit by a rattlesnake, the rattlesnake anti-venom can cost up to $400,000 for the series that a person or a horse has to do. So I have to ask you, is it that way too with these snakes in Australia?
It's not $400,000, but it's very, very expensive.
Yeah.
We were so lucky that one of a very good friend of ours is a nurse in a hospital, and when the antivenins go nearly out of date, they don't like to use them on people, but they're quite able to use them on horses, veterinary. So we got them at a reduced price, and we have so many snakes here. And I mean, it's not unusual for us to see a snake every second or third day in summer. And we go out of our way to make sure that our paddocks are mowed down so that we can see them because they glitter in the sun. Most of our paddocks are in the middle of our work track, so that if they cross the track, they make sand marks. If we see a sand mark, we don't put the horse out. We find the snake.
Do you kill? How do you kill them? That's my question.
We're not supposed to. They're not supposed to kill them, and it's because they're protected species. But you know, I've got a little truck here that I put the manure in, and I jumped in it one day and closed the door to move the truck, and I turned the key on, and the alarm went on for the air brakes on the little truck, and a tiger snake came out of the dash at me.
That'd be it for me. I'd be out of there. That'd be it. I'm done.
That's movie where you see. They say to you, when you see a snake, you keep very still and calm and don't move because your eyesight.
Oh yeah, sure. Okay.
That is complete and utter rubbish. I was out of there so fast that you wouldn't believe. I actually couldn't find that snake because he went under the seat. I knew he hadn't gone away.
Just burn it down.
Drive it over a cliff.
I cut the doors off the truck. I cut the doors off the truck with a grinder. I cut the front out of it. I got exhaust off a car and put pipes into all the channels to find this snake. I couldn't find him. I got back in the truck and moved it a few days later. I wasn't happy. I rang the snake catcher up. He came out, had a look. And while he was there, I thought, there's only one place it could be, in the actual seat. So I got a knife and cut the seat, and it was under the seat.
Oh.
I got him up under the seat, and I'd been sitting on it. But the most dangerous thing about that snake, the tiger snake, is that they can multi-bite you. They're not like one bite. They actually can have 12 bites at you. They can multi-strike you.
Okay, I'm looking at tiger snakes, and they don't look friendly. They're not very.
No,
why
no,
do you people
friendly.
Live yeah, there?
Rattlers scare me because of the noise they make. But I mean, over there and
yeah, but at least
yeah,
they
look,
make
I'm not a king. Noise.
Okay, I gotta ask. We're running out of time. Why do you people live there? That's my question.
I don't know. It's just one of those things. We like people to come out to visit us because we like to scare them with all our pets. Love and the Chevy's actually chasing me around the yard now. I'm out the paddock with him, so I think he wants to talk to you. But anyway.
Oh well, I'm glad the Chevy's doing better. I really am.
When's his next start, Lance?
We're going to look for a race for him. We're going to look for a race for him probably middle to end of next week somewhere. But he's in no hurry to have a race. He's had his comeback. He's had a win, and he's happy. And you know, we didn't ever expect to race him again, and that was not why we saved him. It wasn't because we thought that he should be a racehorse. We just saved him because he's a horse and he deserved to live. And he was unfortunately bitten, and it wasn't his fault. He didn't know that he came from New Zealand. There's no snakes in New Zealand,
and that's where
met one. Yeah. Well, that's right. But, you know, I go to New Zealand quite a bit. And I'll tell you, when I walk through the grass in New Zealand, I still look for snakes.
Yeah, me too. I've done the same thing. Yeah, eyes down snakes. Yep. Yeah. Well, I'm about to go and move 40 bales of hay around a hay shed. So,
good luck.
you reckon my eyes aren't going to be out on stalks?
Well, that's the horse sake that actually bit Love in the Chevy. When they found him, he was found in a hay shed alongside the paddock.
Oh, don't tell her that. Yeah. That's yeah, not thanks, what Landon. She wants thanks. To hear. Yeah.
I'm feeling unwell now. I can't possibly go and help my friend.
Yeah.
Lance, thank you so much for joining us and telling us this
thanks
amazing
so much,
story.
Lance.
And thank you, you know, on behalf of the forever home that that Chevy's going to end up with after you, I'm thanking you for those people.
So. Thank you. Thanks for the interest. And look, Chevy loves it, and I'm sure he, in his own way, he'll appreciate the fact that we've all looked after him, and all the amount of people that were praying for him when he was sick was something else that I just couldn't believe. And you know, there was another little side story in that too. While he was so super sick, I actually got invited to an award night, and I was so tired, I actually won the Living Legends Award. They invited me in the Living Legends, and I knew nothing about it, and I was so tired, and I must have been, it was just like I was in a dream. And they dragged me away from the horse for 4 hours to go to this team. I didn't want to leave him. It was about 4 or 5 days later after he'd been bitten, and I couldn't work out why they'd want to drag me away from this horse when I had such an important job to do. And yeah, I'd won the Caduceus Living Legend Award, and I didn't, that's what had me there.
Thank you.
Congratulations on that, and congratulations on Chevy. That's a great story.
Thanks, Lance.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Well, next up, we have our legal tip, our equestrian legal tip, and that, of course, is brought to you by Chamberlain's Law Firm, and we'll be back with another terrific guest right after this. Well, I have Sayward back with me from Chamberlain's Law Firm with our legal tip of the month here on the Australian episode. And we're going to talk about something that Jennifer and I are very familiar with because we ran a big boarding stable for a lot of years. And I want to just tell you that we're glad we don't anymore.
Hi, Glenn. Yes, it's not the easiest business to run sometimes, is it?
It's not profitable either for the most part.
Yes, correct. All right, so what I thought I'd do, because we've done a lot of buying and selling tips lately, so I thought I might change topics and go on to boarding. Boarding's a situation that almost all horse people have done, probably from both sides at some stage, and I thought I might go over in the first part, so I'll do it as a two-part. In the first part, I'll just go over some general requirements for boarding agreements. And then in the second part, I'll start touching on things that can go wrong in this relationship. General boarding agreements. So I recommend that if you are boarding your horse somewhere, that you enter into a proper agreement so that the parties are agreed on who is responsible for what. And that will also give you a basis on which to have a dispute if something should actually happen like that. When you have agreements that are only oral, you always have some uncertainty as to what the terms are, and also if a matter did actually end up in a dispute, you would also have a problem with your evidence and being able to establish what the terms of the agreement are. That is always easier if they are written down. When they are oral, it's much harder to produce the evidence. So as just a general legal principle, things in writing are generally more reliable. So I'd definitely agree that if you own a boarding stable, you should have an adjustment agreement drafted for you that you use. And if you board with someone, even if they don't normally use it, it wouldn't hurt to have a very basic one drafted for you and ask them if they are happy to do that. And they might be happy to do that. They might even be happy to actually get their own organized and start doing it in writing, just because of that level of uncertainty. I think a lot of people aren't even aware that this can be done quite cheaply. So I think once people are aware of that, it adds a lot more certainty to the arrangement they have with their client.
And I wonder, that would be a good question I'll put out on Facebook, is that for those people that board, how many actually do have agreements? I'm guessing it's going to be about 50-50, but I could be totally wrong about that. We used to, you know, when you're boarding, especially if there's any self-care involved, that all has to be written out, because that's the place where everybody gets to fighting. You know, in our experience, you know, they're supposed to clean their stall, and it should go down to you're supposed to, you know, with very few exceptions, you clean your stall every other day, whatever it is, you know, that's the part that always was a problem.
Yes, self-care leads to its own issues, like those sorts of issues, or, you know, people who aren't turning their horses out and bringing them in properly, or, you know, you sometimes get those owners that aren't actually even feeding their horses. You can have those sorts of welfare issues crop up as well. So there are a lot of issues associated with self-care. So if you do self-care, you're probably going to want some extensive terms in that regard.
Right.
In terms of normal boarding, I think that one of the key things is that you first set out what you actually offer in terms of your services. Now, there are different ways that this can be done. Some people will offer full board, and then they will just list all of the services that are included with that. Some people offer board but actually charge individually for various services, so people can do some things themselves if they want to save money, and then other things they will pay the barn to do. And then there's all the way down to self-care, which is what you're referring to, where essentially they're just paying for the horse to be allowed to stay on the property and for them to use the facilities, and after that everything is done by the owner.
Right.
And so there's a huge variety.
And we didn't do a lot of that, because what we found over time was that the owners never did what they were supposed to do. And the place got to be a mess, which is why we went to full board, because then we at least had some control over what actually happened.
I agree. And most of the time, full board is actually better value if the boarding facility is actually a well-run facility. It should probably be better value for the client. So in terms of the perspective of the boarder, I think that if you're paying full board, it's often worth it, particularly if you're a full-time worker, you're in a profession, things like this. It's actually safer for your horse if someone is least responsible for feeding, turning out, bringing in, rugging, things like that, so that you know that if you get caught up at work, the horse is looked after. It actually lessens the stress, I find, because you know that the horse will at least have the basic needs met if you are, you know, getting caught up at work late at night each night or something like that.
Where do the problems usually come in? So where do the issues, what are the issues that come up the most?
Okay, so first issue that comes up quite frequently is facilities not being well maintained. Now, that's something that can actually be referred to in the agreement, because what I see as a classic example is you have a client who is a boarder at a facility. The horse gets injured due to the quality or lack thereof of the fencing, of the barn, of the footing. Many things can go wrong in this scenario. So all of that liability should be set out in the agreement so that it's clear what the boarding barn is responsible for and what they are not. And that will often depend on what type of boarding it is. In Australia, for example, it's actually quite common for you to pay board, which in Australia they call adjustment, to a facility to use a certain area, but you are completely responsible for that area. So, for example, fixing the fencing, setting up stabling, things like that. That's actually not uncommon here. So in that example, you actually need to maintain your own facilities. You might even be given just basically a bare paddock with some very basic fencing around it, and then you're allowed to make improvements, but those improvements are yours to look after. So that's one extreme, whereas the other extreme is you're paying full board at a proper equestrian center, in which case they need to look after the facilities. Obviously, it's recommended if you do see something that's an issue that you report it so that it can be rectified. But definitely, I think from the perspective of the boarder, you need to always look out for yourself and be aware and note these things. If there's something that you think is dangerous, like say an arena that's a bit old, maybe it's getting a bit of a sinkhole somewhere in the base, that needs to be brought to the person's attention that manages the facility. And then from the perspective of the facility manager or owner, you need to be on the constant lookout for these sorts of things so that no one gets injured and you don't want to end up in a lawsuit for something that you could have easily prevented. So definitely the quality of the facilities is an issue, and that can come up in disputes. Another issue is...
Yeah, I was going to bring up one quick here, and it's something we ran into, so I have personal experience with it. We had a border that we didn't have an agreement on health care while they were gone. And this was back in pre-cell phone days. So they went on vacation, didn't tell us. We couldn't get a hold of them. Their horse colicked, and we didn't have permission to put the horse down at that point. So it turned into a horrible, bad situation. We also didn't have permission to send a horse away to get $10,000 in surgery. So, and we could not reach them. They didn't tell us where they were. They were kind of absentee boarders. So do you address that kind of thing in those agreements too?
Yes, that's a standard clause that I would put in any adjustment agreement, is setting out exactly what is going to happen and what each party is allowed to do in the scenario where a horse gets ill or injured and the owner isn't able to be contacted. So that's an essential term, regardless of what type of board, anything from self-board to full board, that needs to be addressed, because that could happen at any time. Even if people have self-board, it could happen in the middle of the day. Say they come and feed the horse in the morning, the horse colics at lunchtime. The owner's not going to be there till after work, say six. So that needs to be addressed regardless of the type of board that someone has. And if you are boarding somewhere where they won't enter into an agreement, or they don't have that addressed in their agreement, I think that you should put this in writing and actually make some sort of arrangement with them so that it's clear. And that way, you know, the horse will be looked after in a certain way, and the owner is not stressed about what will happen if that scenario develops.
And it does develop. So it's...
Yes, that's right. I mean, we all know if we have horses, they get sick, they get injured, these things just happen. So it really needs to be dealt with, preferably in writing, so that the owner is therefore sure that he knows what he can and cannot do.
Right.
And then decisions can be made quickly when they need to be made quickly, which is usually the case in an emergency like that.
Yep. Well, there's so much more to this particular topic. Can we continue this again next month?
Yes, definitely. There are plenty more topics I'd like to do on the boarding issues.
All right, great. Well, let's do that next month. Tell everybody where they can find you and what the story is there.
Okay, so you can visit our website, www.chamberlains.com.au. If you go to the website, you'll see we've updated it again, and it looks really nice, and it should display better on mobiles. So have a look and visit the blogs. You can visit me on Facebook, Equine Legal Services Chamberlains Law Firm. If you want to contact me specifically, you can do that through the website or the Facebook, or you can also ring the office on 02-6215-9100 or send me an email, sayward.brest@chamberlains.com.au.
Dirt, every inch of me hurts. Guessing wasn't such a perfect landing. Yeah, I'm still alive, not sure how I survived. It was a hell of a ride till it ended. I guess that's what you get when you leave. You don't always end up on your feet. Oh, there's easier ways I could go. Oh, but deep down inside me, I know I really have something to show when I get that pony roll. face the true consequence of a fast turn. Every up, every down, every single go round, every fall I have found makes me stronger. So I'll knock all the dust off and then I'll get back in the saddle again. Oh, there's easier ways I could go. Oh, but deep down inside me I know I really have something to show when I get that.
Well, I hope that the next guest is not quite as dramatic as the last one. Holy smokes. You know, I almost teared up when I talked about the Greyhound we got, because the stories were so similar, right? And I meant that. Someday somebody's going to have a forever home for this horse and is going to feel the same way I did when he was telling that story. Because without that trainer saying, I'll pay personally to fix this dog. They would have put him down. They would have put her down immediately on the track. And that dog, by the way, a Greyhound, lived to almost 14 years old.
Wow, that's really old.
When we brought her late in life, when she was 12, 13, she was having some issues. So I brought her in, and they talked me into doing a whole body X-ray.
Yep.
And when they did, it showed that her back had been broken in three places.
Yeah, look, these animals, they just blow us away, don't they?
That dog ran like crazy the entire years we owned her. She was a typical Greyhound. You would have never known. And when she got to be 12, 13, she slowed down. But, oh, my God. I mean, so there's a dog that was only there because of the trainer. And when we saw those two together a couple of years later after we had gotten her, and the trainer just happened to be at this Greyhound picnic, you could see it. The trainer started to cry, and it was cool.
It was a cool moment. Yeah. That's why we do it. I mean, my little dog is a rescue dog. Someone wanted her put down because her eyes weep, and she's half Chihuahua. Of course her eyes weep. And, you know, she just makes me laugh out loud every single day. And, you know, I like to think she's grateful for not being put down, but really, I'm looking at her at the moment, and she's got my two Burmese cats laying on top of her. So she's living the life.
Well, what about our next guest?
Our next guest is David Shoebridge, who is an Australian Grand Prix dressage rider, trainer and coach. And last week he was possibly the luckiest guy in the world, because he got to have not one but two lessons with Carl Hester at the masterclass with his horses Agent de Jure and Amaretto. Thanks so much for joining us today, David.
Thanks, Fiona. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, our pleasure. Now, most of our Australian listeners would know you as the partner of the wonderful imported Grand Prix stallion 007. Did you start your riding career in dressage? Tell us the David Shoebridge story.
The David Shoebridge story. Well, it's I grew up on a family farm in Tasmania. So we still have it in the family. We had horses on the farm that I would feed and pat and train, give some attention to, but didn't ever really have a riding lesson as such. And as a young schoolboy, I'd feed my apple or lunch or anything that was slightly edible for the horse, to the horse on the way to school, not the way home.
Yeah. Well.
And so that led to obviously a greater interest in, you know, going into the paddock to pat, then going into the paddock to lean on the horse, and one thing led to another, and before long, I was riding the horses. They're actually my aunt's horses, and it was, I think Meg was I mean, everyone's got to have a pony called Meg. She was a Welsh Arab cross, and she had a filly foal who was by a local quarter horse stallion. So I grew up on, you know, riding this sort of Australian, I guess I'd be considered a station bred horse.
Yeah, yeah.
I would ride wherever I could and jump whatever I could. And one thing led to another, and I started to take it a little more seriously than my parents had hoped. So it was obviously a time of big change, because I was the first rider in my side of the family, and my dad's sister-in-law, so my uncle's wife, had these two horses on the farm, but had a quite strong allergy to horses. So she would ride occasionally, but the grasses plus the horse hair didn't really work. So these guys just hung out in the paddocks, attracting my attention for a long time.
Right.
So, it was good. So, you know, my riding didn't start formally. It was really informal. I would use anything I could to put together jumps or put together gear. There was an old stock saddle at home that I'd use, and it was literally a case of saddle up and go riding for a few hours and come back. So, and then if I wanted to jump something, I'd, you know, quite often, you know, once the hay had been cut, that with the big rounds, it'd always be like a little mini round, but one that sort of, there wasn't enough feed to fill it. So I'd go and jump that. I'd jump fallen over trees. When I got a bit more confident and wanted a few complex combinations, I would actually go up to the sheepyards and jump in and out of all the sheepyards. Heaven knows what their distances were or anything. I was just a kid that wanted to jump everything.
Distance schmistance. Now, I need to admit, I'm actually a Tasmanian as well. So we can play 2 degrees of separation
surprised we didn't know each other.
Yeah. That's right. Well, I escaped 23 years ago. I left okay. Launceston the day Sub-Zero won the Melbourne Cup.
Oh, wow.
So that was my, I loaded up my dual-badged Datsun Nissan Bluebird station wagon and put it on the ferry, and off I went to Sydney with no clue, with a big map,
that
with a fluorescent line.
Really Tasmanian.
Yeah, it was so. Really Tasmanian. It only had 4 cylinders, cool. And I once towed a double horse float with a friend's horse in it with it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That is very Tasmanian, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Look, I guess growing up, we did have, you know, an element of isolation. So your community is the world. So I, with the horses, I'd find my own fun. Like eventually, as years went on, my cousin got a pony, and I had a horse by this stage, like my own horse. And my cousin had a pony, and I remember as little kids, my uncle and my grandfather made us billy carts. So we all had. So there are 3 families. So my cousin, my cousins, my brother and I, and then my dad's sister's children, so Canberra cousins would come down for holidays. And so for the Christmas holidays, we'd have our 3 billy carts out. And they're all exactly the same design.
Yep.
And using golf buggy wheels and rope handles. But they're all varying colours, so we had our own colour. And I remember one year, Jenny, my cousin who had the pony, we got this new pony and it was broken to harness.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
I know where this is going. Yeah.
So I thought, wouldn't it be cool to try and design something and turn one of these billy carts into a little car? Oh, that didn't end very well. So I didn't have any of the strapping that you need. So no. I can't remember what I used around the neck, but then I had a surcingle that came on the stock saddle that I used as the roller, and I punched some holes in it and attached some fencing wire, made some loops out of the fencing
Lord.
Wire. Yeah, needless to say, I didn't actually get to sit in the cart behind the pony halfway through hitching the shaft, like one of the shafts, the bloody pony took off. Billy cart going flying, pony petrified of this rotten bloody cart that I built, although I modified. And I just remember a few hundred metres down the road being devastated that nothing was attached to the pony. The first single had gone, the shaft had gone, the billy
cart had gone. The pony had gone.
And the pony's like, that serves you right. Lesson number one.
Yeah, retired, ponies, no.
Retired driving pony. So, no, it was a bit of fun. So, well, I mean,
fantastic.
I could go on for hours with those sort of stories. Yeah. But that was, you know, the basis of the start of my riding. I had to be a bit creative and make my own fun, and it was most definitely sort of self-interest that came in. It wasn't coming from the back of a parent that rode or a sibling that rode. So...
I had similar thing. I mean, so, you know, and can tell similar stories. I mean, I grew up hunting and point-to-pointing and eventing down there. So, you know, every time I have a rider I'm coaching fall off, I ring my mother and apologize because I used to make the poor woman watch me all the time.
I know. It's certainly, it gives you a different perspective.
It does. It's amazing we made it, really. So from such humble beginnings, last weekend you rode with Carl Hester. So that's a little bit of a jump from hitching up your pony to a billy cart.
Absolutely. it is a bit of a jump. You know, obviously over the years I've refined my gear management skills and streamlined my abilities and worked out what I'm good at and what I'm not. And so needless to say, I don't drive ponies in harness. But no, look, the dressage side of things, you know, took off when I moved over to New South Wales for uni. And like growing up, I was, you know, hunter trials, as you were, like, couldn't fathom how people could remember where they were going for a whole 5 or 6 minutes in a dressage test.
Yeah, what are those letters about? That's weird.
I know, and why bother?
Yeah, exactly.
There are no jumps, so why do you want to ride?
No, get us to the cross country. Yeah.
Yeah, look, and obviously as you grow up, you know, the training I develops, and you know, I just love it. I love training. I love developing. And. And the opportunity, so I mean, obviously, but I cut my teeth in Grand Prix with 007, who imported from Holland. And then when he was about to retire, I contacted the breeder, the same breeder, and said, look, what have you got? And it was actually through a friend, Emmy Dazoo, said, look, you know, there is this gelding by 07, but primarily I had a business model that really needed my horses to have two purposes, so riding and breeding. I couldn't have a gelding because there was no backup plan, so everything needed to be commercial and have a plan B if plan A didn't work. So when I saw a video of Agent, I was pretty blown away. Like, it was basic, like just like elementary level. And I thought, look, he doesn't tick the plan B, so he's a gelding. So yes, would he give me something to ride, but you know, needs to take plan B. And the more I thought about it, I thought, you know what, he's a son of 007. So when 07 retires, Agent can fly the flag. So that was the plan. I got Age, and he's been the most amazingly generous horse at times, but also one of the most insecure horses I've had. So he took quite a while for me to really get into and really settle down. Mm-hmm. Legs that fly everywhere and sort of not a lot of rhythm, and he would try incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you would have seen at the Carl.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah. Yeah, that just, you know, but this generous nature really developed, and he's become the most awesome partner yeah. in crime. And, you know, to be invited to present. So I presented three horses to Carl in hope that he'd potentially select one.
Yeah, now I'm interested in hearing how this selection took place, because I'm guessing, I mean, clearly you didn't just ring up and go, hi, I'd like to.
Hi, I'm Dave. I'd love to ride with Carl.
Yeah, yeah. I've got three horses. Let me bring them along.
Yeah.
But did you have opportunity to ride with him prior to that, to the clinic? That
we did, but, and you know, I was sort of thinking, okay, he's going to give me a few pointers, so we're going to look really good on Saturday night, and we're going to like absolutely not blitz it. But I thought, yeah, we're on to it. We're right.
Yeah.
And I rocked up with my first horse, which was a young mare that we bred, and she's my favourite youngster. So
is that Amaretta?
Amaretta. By Umpere, out of a mare we bought in Germany called Daylight, and she's by Donna Schweiss under a hit.
Yeah.
So, you know, Amaretta's by a Dutch stallion out of a very German mother.
I might have fallen in love with Amaretta a little bit on Saturday.
She's a dude. She's really cool.
Yeah.
She's actually really needy in a stable block, but that's it just loves people. But that's that's another story in itself. But yeah, so I presented Amaretta first, and obviously there were, I think there were 10 of us that tried out for the clinic, and we were approached by the clinic organisers based on them scouting, so the organising committee scouting competitions and networks and clinics, and really, I mean, I guess not just finding the flashest horses they could, but horses that could bring benefit that you can relate to see a difference from the start to the finish.
Well, that's the other thing that the clinic actually appeared to showcase at each level, one horse that, you know, was clearly working very competently at that level, and one which may have exhibited some tension or perhaps not move as well naturally. So you actually could see some work through there. And I thought that was a really interesting decision, because we don't all have Amaretta in the stable.
No, for sure.
Know. Yeah.
No, and that's, I think that's the thing with this clinic. It really did make it real. So it's, so look, I mean, for the selection, we then, the 10 of us went in groups for Carl to cast an eye over, and we had half an hour in front of him. And, you know, he didn't know if it was going to be a lesson or just a walk, trot, canter and look at the quality. Mm-hmm. But literally with Amaretta, he said, oh, okay, David, you can walk now, I've seen enough. And you never know. And that was only after 10 minutes, and you never know if that's a good walk or
And, whether it's thanks for coming, there's no callback for you.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'll call you, don't call me.
Yeah, that's right.
and so, but I thought, no, look, I mean, we can all be a little bit stable blind, but you know, I thought, you know, she's pretty cool. And she worked really well in the indoor with all the grandstand seating. Mm. And, you know, the big screens and the scissor lifts and people wiping chairs and doing the rest of it. I was really happy because she hasn't actually, she hadn't been out since she was a four-year-old, and she's now six.
Right.
So Carl did say she's a five-year-old, but she's six.
Yeah.
She's turning six now.
Yeah. That's that whole northern hemisphere,
yeah.
southern hemisphere thing.
Yeah, yeah exactly. Yeah, or like pretending to be northern, which is well yeah. and truly Aussie bred.
Yeah.
So then I rode my next horse, which is owned by a friend, and that's Kalimna Hotshot. And he was in the – so Amaretta is in the young horse group.
Mm-hmm.
Kalimna Hotshot was in the sort of medium advanced horse group.
Yeah.
And then I had Agent DeJou in the big horse group, so
yep.
the you know, medium to a Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And I thought, surely on the basis of probability – so I'm presenting three of the 10 horses. I'd want to really hope he likes one of them.
Yeah.
And
it'd be a sad drive home if he didn't.
Yeah. Look, I had counseled myself. I had prepared the my self pat on the back said, Dave, it's okay. Wasn't your turn this time. Another time. It can happen.
Because, you know, anyway, it's Carl so, Hester.
I know. Well,
yeah.
exactly.
No pressure.
Exactly. No pressure. So. Yeah. Shot around, did my thing, and horses were great. And Carl walked into the arena when I was on Harry, with his hot shot, the middle horse. He said, look, I've got a bit of a problem. I was like, uh-oh. And he said, I actually want both your horses for that same because I think they're great quality. And so I said, oh, cool. He said,
yeah.
But, you know, the organizers said they really just want one rider, one horse. So... And I said, no, look, it's completely understandable. And I said, yeah. And then he said, yeah, so, but I think I do need both your horses. He said, but apparently your Grand Prix horse is pretty good too. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, we haven't competed since Sydney CDI, which was in May. And so I said, things could be a bit rough. So we'll see how we go. And Agent came out and he was great. So.
Yeah.
Carl actually, yeah, he chose all three. So potentially created a bit of a stir having one rider and three horses. As it turns out, Carl, I mean, was giving so much to us riders in the
yeah.
lessons that he was going over time. And so when it came time for Harry's lesson, it was only 10 or 15 minutes until dinner was being served.
Right.
And the break. So at the very last minute, I had to make an executive decision to pull Harry out allow Riley Alexander in.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was absolutely fine. It was their call.
That's the story behind the comments Carl was making about you being the wanted man.
Well, that's subjective.
So, I love it.
Yeah. But, yeah, so that was cool. So Harry missed out, but I certainly didn't like having the first round and then the second last round. So then Agent obviously came in and I found Carl's tips just incredible. And he is – such a knowledgeable yet humble person. I mean, before the clinic, he said to me, I'm so nervous. I haven't, you know, it's a massive crowd. I was like, mate, you're nervous?
Yeah.
Like, you are the master. Like, you're in here. You know what you're talking about. We will be, you know, basically falling on every word.
It's nice to see, though. It's still nice to go, yep, human.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, rather than someone walking around knowing everything
yeah.
and, you know, and demanding the respect, Carl's incredibly humble and, a wonderful fellow.
Yeah. Now, if there was one thing that you took away from riding with him, what was it?
I think the tricky thing is it probably isn't just one thing. I mean, the hard thing with masterclasses is you're kind of doing a show. So it's not just a lesson, but you want to show off the progression that you make. The thing that Carl kept, it was very real. So there were real challenges and there were real insecurities and real problems that we had to address.
Mm.
So I think certainly with Amaretta, he gave me a tip just a little thing that to bring my hands closer together to help with the frame control.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really interesting because I have had a few contact problems with her. She's just so light in the mouth that I actually need her to draw into the bit more and sit in my hand a little more.
Mm.
So like 6 months ago, a year ago, I was actually bridging my reins a fair bit on her. So so that's obviously when you hold your reins normally, but then the loop, the end of the rein, you hold with your second hand. So you're creating this link between the two hands. So your hands start to work as one unit rather than independent. And so that really helped. And then, but then I didn't think that Carl wanted me really to ride with basically my knuckles touching, which is a very similar concept to bridging, yet, I mean, they're just even closer. And so I found that as a great tip. And obviously with Agent, I mean, he's such an extravagant horse. And, you know, it's a real sort of feeling and emotion to have doubt. And am I doing enough?
You know,
am I showing the horse off to the best ability? Is he moving well enough? Is the public opinion going to be good? Do I need to try harder? And so I probably
It's not that you're just working out there on your own with that horse. You know, it is that everyone has an opinion. And I loved that Carl said, you know, people sit back and go, oh, that horse is tense, rah, rah, rah. And, you know, he said, come out, give it a go. And I was like, exactly. Absolutely, because there are a lot of horses that I might think are tense, but I still don't want to put my butt on that saddle.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing, in these public forums, you're really putting yourself out there. You're really putting your heart on your sleeve and saying, look, here, 2,500 people, watch my flaws, you know, watch things I do wrong.
It's incredibly exposing.
It is quite confronting at times. You're being told in front of your peers, your seniors, your judges, your
students.
Client. Exactly. How, you know, you're not doing something well enough. But that's where, I mean, it's up to the person how they take the criticism. And I certainly think, I mean, it was delivered in such a constructive way that you couldn't but laugh or smile about it.
And I mean, I think that word, the key word there is it was constructive. It wasn't designed to make you feel bad. It was designed to help you find a way to make it better. Yeah,
exactly. But I think what I'm saying, my point on that was that sometimes these forums, you get a lot of armchair critics. You get a lot of sort of internet
keyboard warriors.
Keyboard worries, exactly.
Exactly.
And you know, at the end of the day, you have to stay true to yourself and trust what you're doing and believe in what you're doing, and nothing else matters. You know, I came into that arena, and initially, you know, it's probably the first time I rode into a big arena and barely even looked up. I said to myself, I know there are going to be 2,500 people, so that's going to be 5,000 eyes looking at me. Probably minus, I'm sure there are a couple of people in there that may have only had one eye.
And the eyes can't generally work independently unless you do have that glass eye thing. But
So there are a lot of eyes watching me.
Yeah.
But that's not my problem. I'm only focused within the walls of that 60 by 20.
Yep.
And so, and that really helps me ride in there and truly not ride for the public. I just rode in to try and get the best feel I could out of my horse in the arena. And he's come a long way because, well, this is Agent, because when I first got him, I remember going to the Sydney CDI and he was maybe in the advanced or maybe our first pre-St. George. So it was probably a couple of years ago now. Mm. So wasn't when I first got him, but the first time I rode him indoors, it was a disaster. He was, you know, trying to leave the arena. He was, you know, running into people, running over things.
It's always fun.
Just petrified, absolutely petrified. And I remember being led in, and you know, he just couldn't cope. So for him, it was a real milestone.
He was going
to that arena, and
he was very cool. He was very cool. That's great.
So I guess with agent, the biggest thing, like what I'm getting to, is not overdoing it on the trying side of things.
Yeah.
So we both try really hard, so I think we can afford to just back it off a little bit.
Wind it back a bit. Yeah.
Let things chill.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that was announced on the evening, which a lot of people in Australia may not have heard yet, is that there's a bit of exciting news about some stallions being available in Australia for the first time.
Absolutely. So we're really fortunate to have Carl's Olympic gold medalist, Utopia, and his son, Eugenius, available to Australian breeders. So the semen is actually in the country now. And the interesting thing about Eugenius is he's actually crossed between Utopia and Velegro. So he's out of Velegro's sister.
Yeah, it doesn't get much nicer than that, does it?
How incredible.
Yeah.
So really,
make
really
me one of those.
Awesome. exactly.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we all like that? And I think that the really good thing about that breeding is so many people these days, so as a breeder, and obviously I import frozen semen from Europe and sell it here in Australia, so speaking from sales experience, but a lot of people love to breed with, say, a licensing champion or a horse they've seen a photo that has this big neck, and the trot is just incredible and huge, and they go, wow, that is what I want to breed.
Yep.
My viewpoint is a little different. I want to breed horses that have the capacity and potentially obviously it's genetic to level, but the capacity on a genetic and physical level and mental level to be a Grand Prix horse.
Yeah.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest mover or the best looking horse or have the shiniest tail or whatever it might be. But we need...
You've got to be able to sit on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the cross of those two horses, incredible.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty nice.
Incredible.
Well, look, congratulations on work, being able to work with Carl and have all three horses selected.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the stallions. Great. As well. Where can people find you?
So they can contact me at david@davidshoebridge.com.au. That's shoebridge.com.au. And look, there's my Facebook and also the David Shoebridge website.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll be seeing lots of Utopia and Eugenius babies running around next year, and you may have seen that Carl's announced that he will come back to do another one. So
yeah,
I think that's seriously exciting.
Pretty excited about that. Thank you so much for your time today, or this evening in our time here, and all the best with
Thanks,
it. Thank
Fiona.
You.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks, Fiona, for joining us again. Where can people find you?
You can find me at remote-coach.com or Facebook at Remote Coach.
And, of course, you can find all of Fiona's past Australian episodes at horsesinthemorning.com. Just search for Fiona and all of them will pop up and you can take a listen to them. And I wanted to remind you, Fiona, we expect a song and your beautiful Australian accent for Radiothon coming up.
Do I have to sing?
Yes, you have to sing. You're an opera fanatic, and you're the only one I know that even likes opera. So I better hear some opera, you know, and it better be about the show, about Horses in the Morning. You should be able to make a cool operatic thing about Horses in the Morning.
You know, can
you
I phone a friend?
Well, I was just going to say, you could trick us and tell us it was you singing and find one of your opera friends to actually sing it. And if they sang it in some, like, Italian, we wouldn't know what they were singing about.
Yeah, you know, I could,
you could say, this is all about the Horse Radio Network and Horses in the Morning and horses, and we would have no idea. See, you have to be clever about this.
I'm having ideas.
Fiona, you have to get chop chop. Get on this. You only have a couple days left.
I'll trot right on to that.
They have to be in by the 18th, so chop, chop.
Okay.
All right. And we will be back here on, well, we have another, actually, episode. The podcast will be here tomorrow, so two weekend episodes for you this week. And then Monday, Jamie's not back on Monday either. She's on vacation. So we have a special co-host joining us on Monday. So a lot of things going on here at the Horse Radio Network. Thank you, Fiona. Talk to you again next month.
My pleasure. See you next month.